Today in Studio 360, I'll talk with James McBride. He just won the National Book Award for writing the best novel of the year, and he plays a mean sax. James McBride brings his gospel quintet in to play some songs, and we'll discuss The Good Lord Bird, his novel about the gunslinging abolitionist John Brown that is surprisingly funny.
I don't want to write a book that's depressing. Books cost a lot of money. If people are going to invest that kind of money in your work, they should at least be moved to some semblance of happiness.
And we'll stick around the 19th century, where the novelist Kate Manning has fun with language, mashing the dialect of Irish immigrants together with New York street slang.
New York is sort of Irish with all this music mashed out of it.
Her new novel is a provocative rags-to-riches tale of one of the 19th century's most infamous women. That and more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and on today's show, I'll talk with the writer James McBride. His novel, The Good Lord Bird, isn't like any other book about slavery you've ever read. It concerns a 12-year-old boy disguised as a girl who, among other adventures, gets hit on by Frederick Douglass. My conversation with James McBride is later this hour, but first, we learned recently that the NSA has spied on the Pope, the Chancellor of Germany, the President of Brazil, and now the Crown Prince of Stormwind, the Queen Regent of the Dark Iron Clan, and the Goblins of Azeroth.
Though Azeroth was saved, the drums of war thunder once again.
It turns out the NSA dispatched agents to the digital realms of the video games like World of Warcraft and Second Life to look for people plotting attacks in the real world. The newly published revelation comes from documents disclosed by, yep, Edward Snowden. To play a game like World of Warcraft, you assume an identity, pick an avatar, join a guild, trade goods, plan actions. So, for years now, NSA agents have been creating their own avatars, watching and interacting, maybe with your kids or you. What are the tens of millions of people inhabiting these virtual worlds supposed to feel about the government spies in their midst? With me in the studio is Kirk Hamilton, the features editor of Gawker's gaming site Kotaku. Kirk, welcome to Studio 360.
Hi, Kurt. Glad to be here.
So, not that you've spoken to every gamer on Earth in the last few days, but were gamers shocked and or upset by this revelation?
So the sense that I get is mostly a kind of resigned acknowledgement that, yes, of course this is happening. This is just one more in a layer of things that I think they're very used to being or feeling watched at this point.
Really? So, and it's interesting. There is this sense that everything we're doing electronically is already on somebody's radar, but isn't it different if it's on the government's radar?
I think so, though I'm not sure that many people see a huge difference between some of these huge corporations and the NSA.
They can't put you in jail.
That's true, but I think that there's a general sense of I'm not doing anything wrong, so
right. They're
more concerned with, is my privacy being invaded? Are they going to use my information to try to sell things to other people? That kind of thing.
Apparently, the NSA hasn't found anything interesting at all in this operation, but give us a sense of what goes on there and how, in, let's say, 2009, some newbie NSA analyst might interpret the actions that are going on in that world.
These worlds are sort of organized into a series of servers that people log into. You make a character. You know, a lot of people have multiple characters, but you start by making one. You know, the game works that basically you go around this giant, at this point, it's been expanded multiple times.
Forests and mountains and lakes.
Yeah, all kinds of things. And then you team up with people. You can form guilds, they're called, which is like a group of like-minded people who work together to go and take on quests together.
In other words, terrorist groups.
Right. There are some similar organizational ideas going on.
And, of course, violence going on.
Yes, there is. And you can fight against other people, too. There can be player versus player, or you can go just take on computer-controlled dragons.
Thank you.
It seems to me like, you know, if a terrorist organization is going to be planning things online, they're going to have their own lines of communication that aren't being constantly monitored and documented right. by some big corporation like Linden Labs or Blizzard, who make World of Warcraft. The only thing I could see maybe is some sort of like virtual training, like what Hezbollah was doing with that game they made.
Was like the U.S. Army's sort of recruitment training.
Basically taking that idea. And that kind of thing I do think could be, you know, useful for any kind of military sort of
Really? So making your troll jump over walls would be a useful Hezbollah?
It would be if you think about like team building and like learning how to follow a leader and how to give commands. And I do think that the NSA and intelligence agencies in general are smart to be keeping an eye on this. It's probably fun for them too, I would imagine, you know.
Yeah, because you don't think the thousands of Edward Snowdens of the world, a lot of them are gamers, I'll bet.
No, I'm sure, and they get to play some World of Warcraft and learn things.
But what about laundering money? Since there is this has always struck me as strange fungibility between the currency in these worlds and actual money, wouldn't that be at least a thing to think about?
People do sell things in Second Life for real money. And there's like in China, there's a lot of like the whole gold farming thing that happens in World of Warcraft where people, you know, will get a whole bunch of gold and then sell it for real money on eBay or through, you know, third party sources. Like that kind of stuff does get around a lot of the sort of tracking that the companies that run these games do. It seems to me like, you know, what do I know about money laundering? But it's right. I sense there has to be better ways to launder money than doing that.
Like, say, Bitcoin.
Right. Yeah. I mean, just for a start. And so it would surprise me if that were happening. But, it could.
Back in the 1960s, during the anti-war movement, the CIA, the FBI, the Army, military intelligence agencies all had undercover agents infiltrating radical groups, partly to make those members of radical groups suspicious of one another. You don't think that's going to happen here of like, hey, are you a spy or beyond the joking version of that?
It's interesting. I'm not sure. I think that like identity is a really kind of fluid thing online.
Right. And
that
everybody's an undercover agent.
Right. Of some sort, right? Like everybody's putting on another identity to begin with. You're not even looking at what the person actually looks like. So, you know, I think if there was actually activity going on that people were trying to hide, but for the most part, everyone's just playing the game and they just don't really care. Like if you're an undercover cop, okay, great. Like let's go on a raid together and kill this dragon. Like
you'll know better how to do it.
Exactly. Like you're maybe higher level than you would be otherwise. So, you know, I don't get the sense that there's a lot of sort of fear and loathing in Azeroth happening.
Kirk, thanks very much.
Oh, sure, Kurt. My pleasure.
Kirk Hamilton is the features editor of Gawker's gaming site, Kotaku.
Given the history of abuse by governments, it's right to ask questions about surveillance.
You are testing my patience.
So what's all of us? There ain't nobody spying like us.
All is quiet. A New Year's Day.
A year ago, we asked you for your creative New Year's resolutions for 2013. Maybe there was some screenplay you always wanted to write or some photos you always wanted to take. For a few of you, we held you to those resolutions. Last week, we heard from Ariel Lautman, who built furniture for her house. And this week, it's time to check in with two more of our creative resolutioners in the final stretch, Charlie Kapp and Linda Brewer. Charlie Kapp was the guy in Seattle who told us,
I'm going to be making an illustrated version of Samuel Taylor Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner. It'll be a comic book adaptation of the work in 7 parts.
Charlie almost has this albatross off his neck. He is inking the final pages of his epic graphic poem right now. When you first told us about this very ambitious resolution, you said you were aiming for one stanza per page, about 144 illustrated pages in all. Did that estimate work out?
So far it has. Some of the stanzas are a little longer than others, but so far I've kept with it, one stanza for each page.
And was the experience sort of sobering or was it fun?
It's been fun. It's also been a challenge for sure. At first I thought, roughly 12 pages per month, that should be easy. But, you know, life happens and sometimes there's this feeling of falling behind and then having to catch up.
And you knew that we were waiting if you failed.
Yeah, there's definitely I was telling everyone, it's like, no, I got to stay on task because I don't want to disappoint Kurt Anderson and public radio.
There you go. Well, did your productivity change over time? Did you get sort of better at it once you'd been doing it for a few months?
I feel like I've loosened up. Like the first pages might have been much more heavily drafted and laid out compared to these later ones, where I'm a little bit more, I guess, looser with the lines.
A lot of our listeners actually have let us know that they really want a copy of this thing when you're done. Is there going to be some way that that audience, those buyers, will be able to get a copy?
There will be. I'm not sure what form that'll take yet, however. I've been looking at various options that are around for publishing it, so I need to get started on that process and figure out who to contact and how to do it.
Well, I will vouch for the excellence of the drawings if any publishers are out there listening.
Oh, thank you.
And, in fact, I'll blurb it for you.
Oh, okay.
So, publishers, buy this.
Oh, thanks.
Charlie Kapp listens to Studio 360 on KUOW in Seattle. Meanwhile, in Tucson, Arizona, Linda Brewer is just one story away from finishing her 2013 resolution.
I decided I would write a short story every month and send it out, trying to get it published, and then by the end of the year, I would have 12 fairly decent stories that weren't there before.
So you set out to write a story every month, and you have not missed a deadline. Good. By the last day of every month, we've had a new Linda Brewer short story to post on our site. How much did having this self-imposed set of deadlines and the public commitment help you to do that?
It was a tremendous boost because I had a sense of impending shame, I guess, that what if I didn't make it?
Is this the most you've ever written in a year?
Oh, I would think that it is, yes.
A lot of your characters in these stories have been middle-aged single people. You are, I understand, a middle-aged single person. Was that also writing what you're familiar with?
In a way, yeah. Although in the one I'm doing for this coming month, I'm going to break with tradition and not make it be a middle-aged single person. But on the first of every month, I start thinking, what can this story be about? Who's going to be in it? And then, you know, I don't have like 2 weeks to think that up. So I sort of grab a wisp of an idea and start doing my laborious little riff on it. And I guess those are the people that come to mind most immediately.
Apart from the learning to write on schedule as you did and crank them out, did you learn anything else about your strengths or weaknesses as a writer that you didn't know before?
I think my weak points kind of rotated throughout the year. And it was interesting to see sort of writing tics that would pop up, and I would think, oh, I've already done this, you know, six other times.
What kind of writing tics that you would keep repeating?
Well, for one thing, I think a thing a lot of writers have problems with is just logistics and forgetting that in a story you can just plop a character down on the moon if you want to. You don't have to
move them,
build the whole scaffold to get them there.
Right.
It was just very educational in so many ways, and I want to write a little essay to myself at the end to remind myself of stuff I learned before I forget it.
That was Linda Brewer in Tucson. You can read all of her short stories and see some of the gorgeous illustration that Charlie has drawn for The Rime of the Ancient Mariner at studio360.org. And guess what? It's almost a new year. We're looking for some more brave souls to make your resolutions with us so we can encourage and hound you all year long. We're taking those 2014 Creative New Year's resolutions starting right now at studio360.org. Want to know who sang well enough to make Renee Fleming jealous?
When I was a student, I used to travel on the subway between Queens and Juilliard, literally invoking heaven to give me her high C. It never worked.
We will identify that voice just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. A few years ago, I published a novel about the New York City demi-monde in the middle of the 19th century. So when I saw Kate Manning's new novel, My Notorious Life, set in almost the same time and place, I had to read it. The book is absolutely Dickensian. The orphans and street urchins, the secrets of the well-born, the reversals of fortune and amazing plot twists. But it's also grittier and grislier than anything Dickens could have published, because the heroine is a famous abortionist who makes a fortune, a character inspired by a real-life woman. Kate Manning, welcome to Studio 360.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, as I said, your heroine, Axie Muldoon, is based on an historical figure whom I know a little bit about. Now I feel I know a lot more about. Who is she? Who was she?
Anne Lohman?
Yeah.
She was the wickedest woman in New York, apparently. But when I saw that title, her name, The Wickedest Woman in New York, I had to ask why. And it was because she really, I think, was a foremother of the reproductive rights movement. She sold medicines, some of them quite dangerous, which were known to cause a miscarriage. And by advertising these medicines, I think she really let women know that there was such a thing as family planning.
You imagine her deeply, as I guess maybe there are biographies of her, but I don't know them. And she's, in your book, seems like a more real woman than the references I've read to her in histories.
Well, as far as the real woman goes, I don't think we really know that much about her. And because of the hysterical tone of
right.
the 19th century.
She was just a sensationalist
yeah,
press figure.
Exactly. And everyone, they called her things like Hag of Misery. And so I looked through trial transcripts and accounts, as many as I could find, and I saw glimmers of kindness. And also, when you're writing a novel, you have the luxury, the freedom to imagine it the way you wanted to. And my thought was that anybody who would put up with arrests and jailing and the things that, that actual Anne Lohman put up with would have to be motivated by more than money.
I'd read references to her, but I didn't know her real name. I knew of her as her trade name, which was Madame Restel, right?
Right, but she was not French.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I did love plunging back into this time and place, and it is a, in addition to being about reproductive rights, a phrase that didn't exist then, it's a fantastic yarn. But there are probably people who will hear us talking or see this book and go, really? Oh, hundreds of pages about abortion? Do I want that?
No. What,
do you worry about that? Have you worried about that?
Truth is, I started writing a story about a scrappy New York City street kid, because this was an era where there were 30,000 homeless kids on the streets of New York.
Especially Irish kids.
Especially Irish kids. And I wanted to play with language, and I wanted to play with that music of Irish and words. And so this was really a story of Axie Muldoon, a young girl who was trying to survive, and she gets swept up in this orphan train movement, which was something I didn't know about. Shipped west with thousands of other kids.
Which people thought was well-intentioned.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So I was very interested in the era. And as I made my way through Axie's story, I wondered what would become of her. And when I stumbled on Madame Restel and I learned that people thought she had faked her own suicide, I thought that would be a wonderful plot device.
You talk about her Irishness and the language you play with, which you do wonderfully throughout this, and the old New York accent, or what you imagine the old New York accent to be, and her kind of Pygmalionization as she rises up through society. Talk to me about how you found her voice, how you decided how she sounds and how that changes.
I've always been a bit of a mimic, and I like the way in New York, you know, how we talk, the D's and the Do's and the Dems and all you guys going to the store, you know, like that. And having spent a lot of time with Irish people, I listened to them talking about the, you know, D's and Do's and Dems and all you's gone to the store, you know. And I imagined an uneducated young girl of Irish descent, but learning in the streets of the city. So I sort of began to think that Irish was maybe, or that New York is sort of Irish with all the music mashed out of it.
Right. Can we hear a little bit of Axie? Will you read a little bit from the book?
We sure will.
And what is, where are we?
This is a scene where Axie becomes apprenticed to a midwife. And I will take the liberty of reading this in the Irish New York voice that I've been hearing in my head over the many years I've been working on this.
Go
book.
For it.
Under sun and moon both, Mrs. Evans schooled me about evil and good, and the practicalities of administering all remedies in between. A few drops of opium will save the mother pain. Palpation of the belly will determine a breech presentation. A glass full of spirits will restart a stopped labor. Small hands is a blessing. A steady hand is a blessing. A firm hand is a blessing. A warm heart is, and so is a soft voice. Mrs. Evans had these all, whereas my heart was guarded and my voice was mostly silent. I watched and listened and did what I was told. You will see mothers die of prolapse where the uterus falls right out, Mrs. Evans said. You'll see them die when the child is stuck in the canal. Mothers will die of fever and they will die of hemorrhage. Their parts will rip and tear. They will die just of exhaustion. And remember, she said, till you have a child of your own, no woman will accept you for a midwife alone. I went along to 30 births, 16 boys and 14 girls. The mothers moaned and carried on, but when they were through, most of them smiled and looked down at their raw new infants with wet eyes glinting. It's a beautiful gift of God, Mrs. Evans said, her own eyes crinkled with wonder. And it was a wonder. As disgusting as the blessed event seemed to me at first, I soon was dumbstruck at the power and workings of the female machine and never got tired of the drama and the miracle.
That was Kate Manning reading from her novel, My Notorious Life. Can you come home and read that for me? Because I didn't have that accent in my head as I was reading it.
Sure. I like to read aloud.
It's clear from this book that, like me, you loved discovering and using these old words like poltroon and slumgullion and bungstarter. Where did you find your favorites?
Especially what I especially loved was a small dictionary I found called The Secret Language of Crime, a rogue's lexicon. And that was put together by George Matzell, who was the police chief in the city at that time. And he wrote down all the stuff that the bad guys said.
An example?
Like Jack flimped a yak and made off with a spark fawny. I mean, it's so archaic.
And that means?
And it means Jack rolled a rich guy and stole a diamond ring, a spark fawny.
Was there one thing that you learned about the 19th century or the 19th century New York that you hadn't known that surprised you?
Many things. I really found so many parallels to our own times. I felt that many of the issues that we talk about still today seem to have been gelling, and the terms of the debate were set then, particularly when it comes to questions of reproductive rights. I was very interested to see that, of course, we've made so much progress, but that there are still forces that shame and trap women. And I was really surprised by how by some of the similarities, and very grateful for the differences.
Although there was not, to the extent that there is now, such a institutionalized, large and organized anti-abortion movement.
No, there wasn't. And that's, I think, where it began. I think these advertisements that there were many women who, midwives who practiced abortions and sold birth control devices or medicines that would cause miscarriage. But it was by advertising them that both alerted women to the idea that you didn't have to have seven children, which was the birth rate for women at the beginning of the century. By the end of the century, it was maybe less than four.
And of course, they were advertising it suddenly because suddenly there was this proliferation of scandalous, I don't care, I just want to sell papers, newspapers that would take the ads.
Exactly. There was a lot of quack medicine, not just this stuff, advertised, which made, you know, it makes the century very fascinating to those of us who study it because there's so much morality and sin and people making themselves up out of scraps.
Yeah. In addition to now being a novelist, you've had this whole career as a documentary filmmaker for public TV. As you were doing that and winning Emmys, were you, someday I'm going to write a novel, someday I'm going to write a novel? Or was this suddenly, did this just come out of the blue at a certain age?
No, I always wanted to write a novel. I had to make a living. And I liked my job. I loved making documentaries. So I think it's sort of fatal to a novelist to be good at a job, especially a fun job. But I have to say that working as a journalist or working as a documentary producer really teaches you to hang a story on the bones of a fact and to be economical and to get into the scene where you absolutely need to get into it and dispense with unnecessary sidetracks.
And this one took a a little more than a decade to come out since the last one. Are you now on a – do you feel like a couple of years I'll have a new one, or do you just take longer to let the bread rise?
Well, there's a couple of novels in the drawer that are marinating.
Mm-hmm.
and, you know, I think it's a question of teaching yourself on the job, and I have a bunch of kids that are now grown up, and that will give me a whole vast acreage of new time.
Your youngest just went to college.
And my youngest did.
Yeah, you should have novels out every year now. I think.
I know, and so should you.
Kate Manning, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kate Manning's new novel, My Notorious Life, is out right now. We regularly highlight some of the newest selections in the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry. And today, we'll hear this year's final installment. It's a recording from 1959 by an African-American singer who grew up in rural Mississippi. But it's not what you might assume, not blues or gospel or R&B. This record is a collection of Lieder, French and German poems put to music a century ago by Richard Strauss, Gabriel Fauré, and other composers. The singer was Leontine Price, who became one of the 20th century's great vocalists. The record was her debut, called A Program of Song. Tell the story. We hear from a music executive.
My name is Daniel Gus. I got to reissue a number of Leontine Price's recordings, including A Program of Song.
A music critic.
My name is F. Paul Driscoll, and I am the editor-in-chief of Opera News.
And one of the great contemporary sopranos.
I'm Renee Fleming, and I'm a singer. When I was a student, I used to travel on the subway between Queens and Juilliard, literally invoking heaven to give me her high C. And unfortunately, it never worked.
Leontine Price refers to herself as an American troubadour. And with this album, A Program of Song, she announces herself to the world of recordings as someone who can stand beside any other major singer of songs.
You know, the art of the song recital has, to some degree, been marginalized in recent years, and I think that's a great tragedy because the combination of music and poetry in a concert setting that's much more intimate than opera, for me, is absolute magic. And she could do both. Very few singers historically have been able to go back and forth between the two.
What I would say to anyone listening to A Program of Song for the first time is to listen to how personal Miss Price makes this repertoire sound. She's working with David Garvey, who was her longtime accompanist. You hear the gorgeous sound of that voice. It's so beautiful. As they say in the industry, she broke big, and big is where she stayed for the rest of her career.
If you were to examine the biographies of the great singers of the last 100 years, I think you would find that they come to earth in all sorts of places. And there's no reason to think Laurel, Mississippi, which was the birthplace of Leontine Price, should be any less likely to harbor a great artist than any place else. She had a strong family. Her brother George became a brigadier general in the U.S. Army. They were raised to be achievers.
You can't separate Leontine Price from what the situation was for people of her race and color at the time she was beginning her career. Leontine Price was someone who was looking at a career as a concert singer, which was what most African-American singers did, not only in her generation, but in the generation before.
But Leontine Price on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera was a revelation. Her performance in the Great Verdi roles set a standard, not as a sort of, oh my gosh, this is really fresh and new, but because she was so great.
Whether it's the concert repertoire that's on a program of song or the opera arias that she sang it with a great fervent need to communicate what she believed about these characters' situations. I mean, some of the poetry that's included here is incredibly sexy, especially in the Poulenc songs about the burning mirrors, you know, I'm going to set your forehead on fire or whatever. And I think that she delivers that with a great deal of, shall we say, aplomb.
She colors her voice like a painter. She's very fond of using that imagery.
It has all kinds of colors in it, sunshine and then the deep sort of chesty notes that she brings to some of the Strauss pieces, but also the sense of rhythm that she has and the crispness of her language and the joy that she takes in singing.
Velvet, cream, it's just rich and mellifluous and the legato in her sound, the way it sustains, it's even up and down. I happen to love that her debut recording was all song literature. A statement from her saying, I am an artist and in the best of the European tradition and I want to be taken seriously. That sound will never again be heard on this earth. And it's just beautiful. It's beautiful. The fact that a human being can make that sound is one of the great mysteries of singing.
That's Renee Fleming talking about Leontine Price's A Program of Song. We also heard from F. Paul Driscoll and Daniel Guss. Our series, Inside the National Recording Registry, is produced by Ben Manila and Devin Strolovich for BMP Audio.
Gospel music and spiritual music is very simple stuff. It's just triads, major chords, you know, to the four, to the five. But the feel of it is inexplicably very difficult to recreate.
James McBride just won the National Book Award. Turns out he's a pretty great band leader, too.
Judgment. Well, let me try that.
One, two, three. Where you
gonna run to? Where you gonna run to?
Where you gonna run to?
Don't run anywhere. The author James McBride is coming up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right, is that good?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. James McBride was a successful jazz saxophonist before he ever became a successful author. He still plays music, but there's a much better chance you know him from his books. His memoir, The Color of Water, a black man's tribute to his white mother, spent about 100 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. After that, he jumped into historical fiction with Miracle at St. Anna, a World War II novel that Spike Lee turned into a movie. His latest, his third novel, is The Good Lord Bird. And in a way, it combines all of McBride's strengths. It's historical fiction, it's memoir, and it's probably the funniest book you'll ever read about slavery and a murderous zealot. It tells the story of an enslaved child who gets caught up with John Brown's gang of abolitionists in the 1850s. It just won the National Book Award, and James McBride has been touring the country talking about The Good Lord Bird and playing gospel music with his band. James McBride and the Good Lord Bird Band. Hey, good cross-promotional branding. Welcome to Studio 360.
Well, thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Congratulations on this award, first of all.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a nice little ride for me. I went up there with my napkin in my hand. I was eating my apple tart, and then they announced the
not book. Thomas Pynchon, not George Saunders, not Jhumpa Lahiri, but James McBride.
Good old James McBride. What do you think? Old Baldy.
And you've never won anything, maybe, a prize, but you've had a pretty charmed writing life. I mean, your first book, this huge bestseller, your first novel gets made into a big movie. This one wins this big award. I mean, you're batting, you know, a high average.
Well, I've been blessed. That's certainly, I mean, that's one way of saying it. And I'm sure, you know, when baseball players say, they say, how'd you hit the home run? The guy goes, I've been blessed. And the guy goes, yeah, but, you know, what happened was it was a high-hanging curve. But the fact is, you know, I've worked very hard at my craft. I'm 56. I've been in it a long time. I'm very conscious about the quality of my work as opposed to the volume, so mm-hmm. I don't turn out a lot of books, but I try to produce books that I would read myself.
Were you always hankering to write and publish?
No, not at all. I mean, I was, when I did The Color of Water, I was working as a musician. I wrote that book in buses and vans and, you know, wherever I was, you know. But when I was, I guess it was in my early 30s, I had to figure out who my mother was. And I realized I couldn't figure out who I was until I figured out who she was. And since she never talked about her past at all, I had to go find that out.
And your mother, she's like a fictional character. Polish, Jewish, rabbi's daughter, comes to America, marries a black guy in the 1940s, raises these 12 children, sends them all to college. I mean, it's just...
Well, I mean, it's unbelievable, but, you know, we weren't deprived. You know, we were happy.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't like a bunch of mulattoes staggering through life trying to decide whether to, you know, eat matzo balls or fried chicken. You know, we were happy people, you know.
So. Well, and in New York, you can eat matzo balls and fried chicken.
Yeah, we couldn't. We were lucky with just to get the fried chicken. Yeah. And if the matzo balls were there, we'd ate them too. You know, I mean, I used to have a guidance counselor who used to say, you know, you're looking for something. And I'd say to myself, yes, I am. Food.
So, I want to talk about your new award-winning book, The Good Lord Bird. The story is told in the voice of a 12-year-old slave named Henry Shackelford. John Brown takes him in thinking he's a 12-year-old girl and starts calling him Little Onion. Would you read from the moment when Onion and John Brown have their first real interaction? They've just escaped the Kansas town where Onion's father has been accidentally killed, and Brown's trying to comfort the little boy, whom he thinks is a little girl, with the various knickknacks in his pockets.
Okay. Be delighted to read with my trusty assistant, Adam Falk, on piano. Come on, man. I'm sorry. All right. Here, the old man produced the last from his pocket, an odd, long, black and white feather, and threw the feather in my head, tucked it right in my curly, napped hair, then paused a moment, reflecting, staring at that feather in my head. Feather of a good lord bird, he said. Now that's special. I don't feel bad about it neither, giving my special thing to you. The Bible says, take that which is special from thine own hand and giveth to the needy, and you move it in the Lord's path. That's the secret, little onion. But just so you know, you ought not to believe too much in heathen things, and don't stretch the great ruler's word too much. You stretch it here, stretch it there. Before you know it, it's full-out devilment. We being fighters of his righteous holy word, we is allowed a few indulgences, like charms and so forth. But we ought not to take too much advantage. You understand? Well, I didn't know what the hell he was talking about, but being that he was a lunatic, I nodded my head, yes.
That was James McBride reading from The Good Lord Bird, accompanied on piano by Adam Falk. So what made you want to write a novel starring John Brown and this fictional kid?
Well, many books have been written about him, but I wanted to write a book that people like me would read. Books that are written about, like during slave time, that are written about people who were crusaders for freedom. I mean, these people, it's that, like, these people never went to the bathroom or anything. They didn't ever, you know, they never smelled. They didn't have to brush their teeth. And those kinds of books where, you know, with the thunder from the sky is coming, you know, they're not realistic.
Yeah, this people smell here. There's a lot of grit and down dirty stuff in this book. The other thing that books about slavery and John Brown and the lead up to the Civil War aren't is funny, which this regularly is. It's not exclusively a comic novel, but it's, as we heard there, this has a sense of humor.
Well, yeah. I mean, I come from a funny family, and I think I like to laugh, and I like to read stuff that makes me laugh. And I don't want to write a book that's depressing. And, you know, books cost a lot of money. You know, you want to – people, if people are going to invest that kind of money in your work, they should at least be moved to some semblance of happiness, even if briefly.
Onion, this kid, provides a lot of comic relief throughout the book. But he's not totally charming. He is stubborn. He can be obnoxious. He doesn't want to work hard if he can avoid it. Where did you get this character and this voice?
Well, I mean, you just described me. So maybe, you know, there's some parts of me in there. I just liked the fact that this character is filled with ambivalence, doesn't really want to be free, is happy where he was.
Liked his slave master.
He had a good relationship with his slave master, had a nice warm bed to sleep in, got all he wanted to eat and so forth. And didn't really know any better. And unfortunately, I'm sure there were many, many blacks who were like that. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't wake up thinking of freedom. But all of us wake up thinking of winning the lottery or, you know, quitting our job. It doesn't mean we're going to do it.
Yeah. Now, the fact that everybody thinks he's a girl and he dresses as a girl provides a lot of some like it hot comedy. But what made you decide to have this gender confusion?
Well, first of all, I didn't feel I was good enough to write about a real girl. The other part was that him having to play a girl just created a lot of comical situations. And I, you know, if it was one thing that writers talk about when the mic's not on is they talk about sex and all those nasty things they're not supposed to be talking about. And so I just thought it was funny to kind of find some blue material to get. And I thought this would really be a good way to play with that within the framework of this story.
Mm-hmm. One of his charming parts, this kid, is that he sings a lot, and he can't wait to break into song. Again, like you, I guess. I mean, you're a musician. Was that fun, making up his music?
Yes, indeed it was. And the effect of music on the pro-slavers in particular was always something I really liked, because he would sing a song and these big, mean, six-gun shooting, you know, pro-slavers would bust into tears and, you know, ask for their ma and stuff like that.
Well, on that note, talking about music, should we have some music? Will you play?
Of course.
What are you going to play?
This song is called Cinnamon.
Cinnamon.
Where you going to run to?
Where you going to run to?
Where you going to run to?
Cinnamon.
Where you going to run to?
Judgment Day.
Judgment Day.
Cinnamon.
Where you gonna run to?
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 Judgment Day.
Judgment Day.
After a while.
After a while.
It'll all be over.
All be over.
After a while.
After a while.
Sun will shine.
Sun will shine.
All of my troubles.
All of
trees, and the trees will be burned. You better run to the sea, and the sea will be boiling. You better run to the trees, and the trees will be burning. Who are you gonna run to?
Where are you gonna run to?
Oh, judgment day.
That was James McBride and the Good Lord Bird Band playing Sinner Man. James McBride on saxophone, Keith Robinson on guitar, Trevor Exter on bass, Adam Falk on piano, and Showtime Brooks on drums. Now, The Good Lord Bird, the book, is about this time and this man, John Brown, in the 1850s, but it's also very much about the music of the era. What was it, the spiritual music that led you to John Brown?
No, no. That occurred after. Because one of the things that was really interesting about John Brown was that he was deeply religious. And he was seen as a nut. You know, he's still seen as a nut.
Yeah, and you don't portray him as not a nut entirely.
Yes, well, he was kind of nutty. Yes, indeed. but he was powered by his sense of religiosity, by his sense of religion. And
as abolitionism so widely was.
And I'm glad it was.
Yeah.
And that religion is powered by music.
The Good Lord Bird has a lot of deeply pious religious characters like John Brown, but also some sinners. Some of those sinners are redeemable. But then there's Frederick Douglass, who is not depicted as the saintly figure we know from history, but as this pervy, pompous drunk. I wouldn't be surprised if you're getting some negative reaction to that depiction.
Yeah, I've gotten a little bit of backlash about that. I mean, it's a book of caricature. So if people want to read about the real Frederick Douglass, they're welcome to read another book.
Right.
But it's true, and I should point out that Frederick Douglass did have a black wife and a white mistress, and they lived in the same house at the same time. Frederick Douglass was a friend of John Brown, and John Brown did ask him to come to Harper's Ferry with him, and Frederick Douglass said, "I'm sorry, that I will not do." But he did, you know, he physically and literally fought against slavery. But he was also a man who, like me, would not have done it. I would not have gone with John Brown during that time. I just don't have the heart. You know, the 19 men who did were unconsciously brave. You know, 15 white guys and the four black guys, you have to remember that they must have been just out of their minds. Because when you read the accounts of what happened to these fellas, it breaks your heart, and it also makes you admire what this country is capable of. America, we do a lot of things wrong, but we do more things right. And I think John Brown and his band of men are indications of this. They're proof of that.
James McBride and the Good Lord Bird Band, thank you all for being here today. And before I let you go altogether, will you play us out? End the show?
Yeah, we're gonna play out with some jam. All right.
You can hear another song from James McBride's Good Lord Bird Band at studio360.org, where you can also hear my full conversation with James McBride. And that's it for Studio 360 today. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisperum,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Julie Dorio,
Zachary McCune,
Felicity Sheehy.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiekem.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org, and by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the director Julie Taymor walked away from her Spider-Man nightmare into a beautiful dream. Her brilliant new production of A Midsummer Night's Dream brings the spooky back.
There is a kind of dark, dangerous wildness to our inner instincts.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.